Who affected the world?
Or their particular place. Who do you think had the most effect on society?
Well, I have to say Jesus.
Interesting.
I've gotten in my... Well, only because Christianity spread globally and has impacted so many developments that, I mean, even like Muhammad and Genghis Khan, like those guys were not quite to the scale and lasting.
Wow. I wondered about Muhammad. Well, I thought you'd say that too.
We're on the same wavelength.
Yeah. It might be indoctrination. My sister Natalie, who was a history teacher, gave me that word.
Yeah.
She goes, you may be surprised to know you may not think on your own. You've been indoctrinated already.
Says, well, I try not to proselytize, but hey, you never know.
You know what that word was, which is what I like.
Well, I may not claim to know everything. I know what I know, including some words.
Yeah. Wow.
All right, time to get things rolling. All right, just a reminder of a couple of things. What?
Oh. Yeah, one of our, Bryce Kissy, he says on his way to here, and his car started smoking.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you the last time I saw him.
Oh.
So. And on that, I was just going to say something. Don't forget, in this class, we do have an attendance policy, and I think only James has, and Nathan as well, has perfect attendance.
I think mine's perfect, so I think we need a little recap.
Wait, Jordan? No, I bet you're missing one.
One class?
In between the snow days.
What?
I just missed last class.
Nope, Tyler's perfect as well.
Let's take that little one absence off.
No, it doesn't work that way.
Like, one time.
No.
I feel like that's what Genghis Khan would do.
No, he'd probably kill you, let's be honest.
Do I
only,
I think
it was
one.
All right, so anyways, so remember how it works. If you have perfect attendance, and I think there's actually three of you, if you keep perfect all the way through, you get extra points added to your average. If you have between 1 and 4, no big deal, that's what I give them to you for. But there's penalties for every absence over 5, well, 5 and above, up to 12. And if you miss more than 12 classes, you get an automatic F.
What's the automatic F?
12.
Oh, 12 is great.
It is.
That's like half the
So, keep that in mind. So if you got perfect attendance, keep it going. If you've only missed one class, you got a couple more, but just save them just in case it's an emergency.
Sure.
You know, but if you've missed more, then hey, you could always do some of the extra credit work. You can do the section reviews. I explained that on the first day of class, so you can make up for those absences. Just don't miss too much. We also have third exam coming up soon. We have your paper due on April 22nd, and we have our final exam on whatever day it was. I don't remember off the top of my head, but you can look at all the dates for that. That's on my webpage, propertymanic.com, on the front page. I think you guys are the Thursday. You're either the Thursday or the Tuesday of finals week. Either way, I'll be here. And unlike exams 1, 2, and 3, which are engaged, the final will be a paper exam in class. When's the date? Oh, I thought you already had it. So, what does that mean? Just keep working hard. You'll be fine. All right. So, we were talking about the Opium Wars. Again, if you want to talk about interesting events in history, how can you not look at something like the Opium Wars and not think that they are just truly bizarre? I mean, England literally used drugs to force their way into China, destroying their Canton system, upending the favorable balance of trade that China had been maintaining for hundreds of years, and then imposed uneven treaties
And then the moment England got it, other countries wanted it as well. And one by one by one, China, this empire, which can trace its history back to, I think the Xia dynasty was their first one. I think that was like 3000 BC.
This empire, this imperial system that's been there for so long is suddenly being beaten at their own game.
Well, needless to say, the sudden defeats, the incursions by the Westerners would have an impact at home, including widespread rebellions. If you would recall when we first talked about China, we talked about something called the dynastic circle. And it's the belief that dynasties live and die based on the mandate of heaven, the Tian. If the heaven blesses the dynasty can rule. But heaven will revoke that blessing. And people looking around their world can see the outward proof. You start having natural disasters, which of course sometimes leads to rebellions. And the moment things are out of control, then according to the dynastic circle, the dynasty can be removed. Well, lo and behold, in the wake of the Opium Wars, widespread rebellions start erupting throughout China. The most significant of which is the Taiping Rebellion. Now, the interesting thing about the Taiping Rebellion was how it started, who was involved, and what happened. This rebellion was a reaction to the arrival of the Europeans. This was a reaction to the clear weakness of the dynasty. But it also resulted because of the foreign ideas that were creeping into China. And they would infuse together in Chinese ideas, essentially creating one of the worst catastrophic events in human history. Now, the leader of the rebellion was Huang Xiuquan. Now, Huang was typical of men of his class. He was born into a family where many of the family members had taken the imperial exams. So, Huang would go to the Imperial Academy. He would prepare to take the exams in hopes of becoming a scholar gentry. He wanted to become a government official, get a nice cushy government job. But the problem was Huang was not necessarily the best and the brightest. He would take the exam, fail. Then he would go back and take it again, fail. And then he would take it a third time and fail.
The failure hit him so hard, he would have a complete breakdown. At some point over the weeks and months of recovery, he would have a vision. And in his vision, he believed he visited a divine plane. And on the divine plane, kind of like a paradise slash heaven, he would learn that he had a celestial family, distinct from his earthly family, which included a heavenly father and a heavenly mother and an older brother and a sister-in-law and a wife and a son. Well,
that gave him hope. Because this celestial family embraced him, loved him, encouraged him, saying that he was destined for great things. So then he decides to take the exam for a fourth time. Because as I said when we did the imperial exams, you can take it as many times as you want. Well, he goes in, studies up, learns the five books, and the four books and the five classics, learns Confucianism, is ready to go, takes the exam, and boom! Fails again. He's lost. Well, at some point, he comes in contact with pamphlets that are now starting to appear in China in the wake of the Opium Wars. Because under all of these uneven treaties, missionaries can come in. And what do you think the missionaries bring with them?
Opium.
They do that too. But they also bring
the word of the Lord.
The word of the Lord. Exactly. So Huang, lost, starts reading some of these Christian pamphlets, and suddenly he becomes convinced. His celestial father is God. And his older brother is Jesus. So what does he start doing? He starts preaching. And his teachings are a weird amalgamism of Christian and Confucian thought. Well, there is pushback by the dynasty of these foreign ideas. So soon, Huang's followers begin organizing themselves in militias to protect themselves. Well, it would be only a matter of time by the early 1850s, just as the Second Opium War is coming to a close, that these Taiping warriors started actually engaged in pitched battles with the Chinese Imperial Army and starts winning. Why? Well, the Qing army is demoralized. They just got their asses handed to them by the Europeans. And they proved to be little to no resistance against these armed militias. Now, interestingly enough, these Taiping rebels even opened their ranks to women. They had entire units of what were called Hakka, female warriors. Now, ironically, under Confucian's ideals, they would basically get a death sentence. Because I know some of you probably watched that Disney cartoon of Mulan. Sorry, Chinese girls were not allowed to go military, even secretly. That never really happened. Well, the problem was, is that the Chinese soldiers were like, oh my God, these women, they're crazy. And they would attempt to fight, but the moment they would go after the women, all the Taiping men would come after them. Soon, battle by battle, village by village, town by town, even city by city, they literally start carving out an empire. Huang proclaims this to be the heavenly kingdom. He would proclaim the capital to be Nanjing, which is just beyond Shanghai. And at its height, he ruled over 30 million people. What more sign do you want that the dynasty is on the verge of collapse? Unfortunately, Huang would make a tactical error. Now, here is a lesson on how to successfully conquer. You have to follow the Roman model. The Roman system was not trying to conquer everything all at once. No, you take little bits. Because when you take little bits, you can then absorb and assimilate the population before going on to the next. And essentially, you are naturally growing. You can't conquer and establish an empire in 10 years. You have to do it over multiple lifetimes. Well, Huang believed that the Qing were dead and nothing could stop them. So they decided to march to Beijing, the northern capital, to overthrow the Chinese emperor, claiming that the Heavenly Father has given him a new type of mandate to establish the heavenly kingdom on earth. Well, unfortunately, Sun Hong and his commanders began squabbling. They began fighting over spoils, arguing over who's actually in charge and what routes should they go and what type of methods they should use. Soon, some of the soldiers see the officers fighting and they're like, what am I going to die for? They began leaving. Plus, not to mention the fact that the vast majority of the people that they ruled over were not members of the Taiping. So, a lot of the people that liked the idea of overthrowing the Qing because they were weak and corrupt didn't like what the Taiping were actually doing. For instance, they were pseudo-communist. They rejected the notion of private property. They said that everything was owned communally. Plus, they called for equality with women. China's a patriarchal society, has always been. Women were, again, to use the yin and the yang, you know, women are the dark side. The men are the light. Plus, they began attacking a lot of the local customs, going after Confucianism, going after Buddhism, going after the folk religion of the more rural towns that worship like local gods and their elders, their family. Hong would go so far as to proclaim that he should be worshipped as being semi-divine. Well, as a result, it was like a meteor streaking across the sky, bright as it goes by, and then it just kind of fizzled out. Because the more aggressive they got, the more word would spread throughout the rest of China. Now, the Chinese understood that the Qing were Manchu, that the Qing were foreigners. But the Chinese allowed the Manchu to rule because, as if you recall, the Manchu adopted the guise of imperial tradition, including Confucianism. Well, this economic equality, this gender equality, that's antithetical to Confucian values, which is their core philosophy, their core value system going back centuries. It was their right. Anything else was wrong. It's also the system that authority, social authority, rested. So with the Taiping smashing ancestral tablets, ancestral shrines, burning scrolls, destroying books, pushback came. Not from the throne, but by the people who actually govern the country. The scholar gentry. Who are you?
Hero.
I got it backwards. Is that Deshaun?
Yes.
Okay, all right, I got him confused. All right, very good. All right. So what ends up happening is all of the regional rulers all across China begin organizing and pushing back. These provincial rulers had the ability to organize their provinces. Again, not out of loyalty to the throne, but to preserve Confucian culture, to preserve Confucian society. One of the most significant was Jianghu Feng. Jianghu Feng was an effective bureaucrat. But when word of the Taiping spread, he began organizing his province, collecting money, recruiting soldiers, buying weapons. Essentially, he would make himself a warlord. He would build an army that was loyal to him. And he would take these forces and start battling against the Taiping. When other scholar gentry saw what he was doing, they began doing the same thing. They built their own armies, they made an alliance, and they began stopping the advance of the Taiping. Now, I'm making it sound quick, but we're talking a near 15-year span of history. At the beginning, everything was going the Taiping way. But then by about 1858, 59, things start switching in the other direction. So much so, by 1864, Jianghu Feng, the alliance of these warlords with the alliance of their armies, would actually invade the Heavenly Kingdom and began brutally crushing the Taiping resistance. The most gruesome event occurred in 1864, when the alliance of warlords would lay siege to Nanking, the capital of the Heavenly Kingdom. And then during the attack, over 100,000 people died in the attack on the city. We're talking men, women, children. Some of the most fanatical adherents of the Taiping, they would actually set themselves on fire rather than being captured. It was truly cult-like. And then on top of it, in the midst of the siege, Huang tried giving himself a drug-induced vision, hoping to connect with the Heavenly Father to get guidance. But unfortunately, he ate the wrong drugs. And in the end, he ate poisonous weeds and died. But without this individual who this cult of personality was created around, in the following weeks and months, the Taiping movement just completely imploded and faded away into nothingness.
But he saw God.
Oh yeah, he got to be right there with God. That's for sure. But when you analyze what took place in this rebellion, 20 million deaths? Now in a country that had 400 million, that's not necessarily a big deal. But it's still 0.5% of their population. 5%. 10%? I can't do math on top of my head. Whatever percentage 20 million is of 400 million. By the way, this ranks in terms of deaths up there. It's more than the deaths in World War I. If you can combine what like Stalin did and Hitler did in World War II, yeah, it's below that. But we're talking that range. One of the most deadliest conflicts in human history that you never heard about before. So, it was obvious that China had problems. The Opium Wars, crippling. Taiping Rebellion, crippling. But they weren't dead yet. So, there were many in China that basically said, look, kind of like what happened in the Ottoman Empire, we need to do something. Because if we don't, we will die. But, what are you gonna do? What can you do? So even though many people agreed something had to be done, just like we saw in the Ottoman Empire, they didn't know what to do. They couldn't agree on what to do. And not everybody in power felt something had to be done. So what would they try? Well, in general, post-Taiping, so now we're talking 1864, FYI, we only got about 40 years left of Qing history. About 40 years left of the Qing dynasty. Dynastic circle, we're probably at about 10 on our clock. So what would they do? Well, historians acknowledge there would be two restorative attempts, two efforts of what the Chinese called self-strengthening. The first is known as the Tongji Restoration. This would be a restoration named after the emperor. What's today's date?
25th.
Yeah, I can do that.
Sorry.
Oh, that's tomorrow. All right, that wouldn't be that bad. All right. Screw my day up, but $200 out of it. All right. So the emperor at the time, Tongji, this movement would be triggered by the scholar gentry, spearheaded by men like Zheng Guofeng and his allies. They decided among the problems that China was facing was, oh my God, the same problem that everywhere faces, corruption. They would attempt to revive the economy. Back when China had a favorable balance of trade, back when the silver was flowing into China, not flowing out. But they weren't just looking backwards. Interestingly enough, they were also looking forward. Because they recognized they are inherently backwards. And why are an army of 10,000 Europeans able to defeat an army of 300,000 Chinese? It's because of their technological advantage. So, the reformers basically said, well, maybe instead of necessarily trying to fight the Westerners, maybe we should come to terms with them and have them help us build up an infrastructure. You know, bring in foreign capital. We'll build railroads. Bring in foreign capital. Maybe we can fix our canal system. Bring in foreign capital. We'll set up factories. We'll start producing things and in a modern economic environment. And if done properly, We can, sorry, I thought there was modernization. I saw it up there. We could modernize our armies. Instead of sending soldiers with swords and spears, maybe we can make some gun factories. Instead of sending our little Chinese junk ships, maybe we can figure out how to make modern ocean-going vessels. Maybe instead of relying upon the world to come to our door, maybe we can start sending ships out and doing business like we used to in the Asian Trade Network. But the problem is, this effort would fail. And it would fail for multiple reasons. But it's emblematic, symbolic, of the reason why change is never easy. One, even some of his contemporaries, some of the other scholar gentry, they were skeptical of these ideas. The Manchu in particular did not want to modernize because their basis of power was tradition. So, in order to get the ball rolling, you did need some upfront cash by the throne. You needed line items in the budget. Well, every attempt they would attempt to do something on a national level and put a project in the budget, magically it would be erased. It would be eliminated, and the money would go elsewhere. Plus, the Chinese are racists. And you had a lot of racism going on in China. Because don't forget, the Manchu were foreigners. They're not ethnic Han people. So in the Manchu's mind, using the 19th century racist model, it was the Manchu who conquered China. Thus, it's the Manchu who are the master race. Zheng Kufang and those are Han. They're racially inferior. Why should the Manchu give up control to these people then? And Westerners, they're outright barbarians. Plus, if that wasn't enough, by this point, the imperial throne was not an absolute authority. China had become completely decentralized. All of the power was in the individual provinces. But you take the 30-odd provinces, each one might have been powerful on their own, but they're all competing against one another. They're not all cooperating. So you couldn't get all the provinces to work on the same page, and the imperial government didn't have the authority to make them work on the same page. Because now, thanks to the Taiping, all of the provincial leaders are warlords. They have their own armies. And I'll tell you one thing. If I had my own private army, I would not listen to anything that anyone told me. Because I have my own army. Why would I have to? So you know what ends up happening? Fragmentation. Many of the warlords basically decided, look, if we can't do this as a nation, we'll do it territorially. So, there was some military modernization, but they were on the local level. So, the wealthy warlords would bring in Western officers and start training their warlord army in Western tactics. But the irony is, some brought in German, some brought in French, some brought in American, some brought in British. So no two army was the same. Some of them did build up their military infrastructure. Some of them did build up their military capacity. But again, if they're getting experts from the different countries, try getting a bullet. If you know nothing about firearms, every single firearm takes a different type of cartridge. So if you're trying to have a national military force made up of 20 different armies and there are 20 different types of rifles that are used, that means you have to have 20 types of bullets. So in the end, the warlords, when they were stymied trying to reform the country, they said, fine, whatever. We're going to worry about our own. Which suddenly made them even less loyal to the throne. Question? Jane? So, Tongji Restoration would fail. But efforts to reform would come up again in the 1880s, in 1890s. Why? Well, China was not getting any stronger. This time, unlike the Tongji Restoration, where it would be the warlords trying to reform, the Hundred Days Reform, it would actually be spearheaded by the emperor himself. The emperor at the time was Guangzhou. He and his advisors were looking around the country and seeing what was going on. And what was going on was nothing but defeats. Yeah, we covered the Opium Wars, but we don't have time to talk about the Sino-French War when France attacked China on their own.
Who were they fighting? Each other?
What?
Who were they fighting? These?
They were fighting against the Chinese to take more land, more power,
so
more privileges.
So they like would go after the same goal.
Oh, no, the different warlords?
Yeah.
No, they would kind of do their own thing.
Okay.
Beginning in the 20th century, they would kind of start battling against one another.
Okay.
But for the most part, they're not answering the call.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons why the French were able to defeat the Chinese, because most of the provincial warlords said, we're not sending our troops.
Wow.
Plus, every single few years, a new unequal treaty would be negotiated. China would slowly be forced to give up more and more and more rights. More and more ports were seized and spheres of influence were created. And again, as I already told you, by 1890, something like 99 ports were held by the Europeans. There were tens of thousands of Westerners parading all through China. But as interesting as that, what really motivated the emperor was when they were defeated by the Japanese. In 1894, China and Japan went to war over Korea. Now, traditionally, the Chinese viewed the Japanese as a tributary state, someone who had bent the knee. Now, centuries before, they did. But as we're going to see when we finish up with China and go to Japan, by the 1890s, Japan had done the one thing that no other nation on earth had done. They had modernized along Western lines. So they were fighting like Europeans. And they kicked the living snot out of the Chinese and seized Korea. Well, when the emperor gets the reports of this defeat, these peoples, who again, remember, the Chinese are racists, the Manchu believe they are the master race, and suddenly these little islanders beat a mostly Manchu army, it was outrage. So the emperor calls for top-down, bottom-up modernization. Similar to the reforms associated with the Tanzimat period in the Ottoman Empire. The emperor calls for a new constitution. The creation of a constitutional monarchy. They want capitalism. They want agricultural colleges, like UMass Amherst started off as. They want trade schools. Yes, they want a modern military. Yes, they want a modern navy. But they also want railroads and mining and factories. But the emperor and his advisors understood the most important thing they needed to get rid of to accomplish those. In 1897, they called for the abolishment of the imperial education system. Instead of only allowing a few elites, they wanted public education. They wanted to raise all of China in their educational standards. Because clearly, only having a few thousand people who are educated in a country of 400 million is not working out too well. Questions? Again, they have receipts. All they're doing is looking in their past. Look, we lost here, we lost here, we lost here, we lost here. So let's see if we can do something about it. But amazingly, once again, the reform movement ran into a wall. Because the people that would be entrusted to implement reforms, the elites, were opposed to it. Why? Well, this is too radical. We can't make everyone in China educated. Most of the Chinese are stupid. We can educate the Manchu, but not the Chinese. We can't give equal treatment and equal rights to the Chinese. They're inferior. Plus, if you have absolute authority, and you give up that authority, suddenly you're not special. So, many of the conservative ministers at court worked with an extraordinary person, Zhu Xi. Zhu Xi was the Empress Dowager. The Empress Dowager. Now, the Empress Dowager is a position given to the mother of an emperor. She, however, was never the legal empress. She was a concubine. One of the women that slept with the emperor. She was with Xianfeng, the ruler that was in charge at the beginning of the Second Opium War. Together, they would give birth to a son. Zongji, who would become emperor when his father died. The moment he was elevated, she was elevated as well. But in 1871, Zongji died. So what she decides to do, because Zongji had no heirs, she decides to pick a new emperor from her own family. Kind of like a dynastic coup. She chooses, where is he? Guangzhu, who is her nephew. from 1871 up until 1898, for the most part, Guangzhou was content to sit back and let his aunt dominate politics. But after getting their butts whipped, he's an adult, decides to start making imperial decisions for himself. Only she doesn't like that. Now, she can't kill her nephew, but rather, she launches this coup d'etat. The emperor is seized, and he's put into one of the back areas of the Forbidden Palace. He's basically put under house arrest. And he would stay there until his death in 1908. And then she takes control, proclaiming herself to be regent. So now she's actually governing in the name of the emperor. And with this authority, she begins to crush all reform efforts. Anyone calling for reform is either executed or exiled, driven out of China. All of the money that Guangzhou had set aside for modernization was redirected. One of my favorite pet projects that she wasted billions of dollars on, in the Forbidden City, was an artificial lake. And what she decides to do, she orders the construction of a huge marble yacht. Again, water, pond, yacht, like a boat, made out of marble. It's got a sink. But you know what she does? She orders a base to be built up in the middle of the lake, and the marble yacht is built up on the pedestal. So she can get rowed out and she can stay on this wonderful, gorgeous marble yacht. The yacht doesn't move. Now, by the way, the estimated cost of the yacht, they could have bought 10, at the time, modern naval vessels. We're talking, in modern money, trillions of dollars. But if there's no money, well, there's no money. As for the Europeans, she began playing one against the other. Promising one a little bit, but saying, oh, I can't give you this much because they are there wanting it, and then have a conversation with the other country. Oh, by the way, I'm thinking about giving this to you, but now, like, say, Italy wants it, but Germany wants it. Oh, but the Americans are there. Oh, you got to look out for the Russians. Trying to divide and conquer. So, she seizes control. And she starts playing a game. And she does it effectively. Effectively. For about 2 years. Until she overplayed her hand. At the same time as she's trying to play the Europeans against one another, she also begins to secretly back movements that are popping up in and around China. People that are angry with the barbarians. Some calling for the use of violence in hopes of driving them out of the country. One of the most violent would trigger an event known as the Boxer Rebellion. All right, it's going to go in a second, but I'll let you write Boxer Rebellion down. Questions? The Boxers, technically, are known as the Yuetuan. The Yuetuan is Chinese for, bless you, for the Militia United in Righteousness. So this was a socio-religious movement. Now, what caused them to organize was in 1900, a severe drought struck China. Ponds, rivers, streams began drying up. Crops began dying in the fields, and famine spread throughout the land. In a spiritual sense, the members of the Yuetuan claimed this is heaven's punishment for allowing us to give entry to our country to these barbarians. So, we must purge China. Their slogan was simple. Support the Qing. Exterminate the foreigners. Now, the Yuetuan movement was cult-like. They believed that they couldn't go get themselves mentally into a trance. And if they said the right words and had the right mindset and engaged in the mystic physical actions, that the spirits will imbue upon them spiritual body armor that will make them impervious to foreign weapons. So, essentially, they believed they could do whatever they want, whenever they wanted to the foreigners. Now, their first targets were soft targets. If there was a group in a village and they learned of a Christian minister there, or a missionary, of course they're going to go kill them. Isolated, all by themselves. But soon they began emboldened. And they started realizing the only way to get out all of the ministries and the ministers and all of the businessmen and all of the Europeans was to go after the embassies. If they could drive out the ambassadors, then all the people will flee. So they actually decided to attack Beijing. They wanted to attack what technically became known as the Legation Quarter. So if you recall, as the result of the Second Opium War and the Tientsin Treaties, each of the European powers were allowed to build embassies in Peking, just outside the wall of the foreign city. I mean, the Forbidden City, the palace where the emperors lived. And these embassies literally were side by side with the different government buildings. Well, the Tientsin basically said, we can get them there. Sorry, the Yuetuan, wrong group. We can get them there. They're soft targets. They would actually lay siege to the city for 55 days. Chinese Christians, foreigners, anyone caught would be killed on sight, brutally murdered. Of course, the irony is when they did this, a resistance group was organized by the German ambassador. And then the Japanese, the Austrian, the Russian, the British, the French ambassadors all got their people together and went to the German embassy because the German embassy had the most soldiers there. Of course, the irony is 15 years later, all those nations would be fighting against one another in World War I. Well, when Jershi heard about this, she ordered the Imperial Army to join the Boxers and attack the Legation quarters. So the Imperial Army mobilizes, marches into this area, and begins trying to take building by building. But the Europeans hold them off. Because the one things the Europeans have now at this time, they all have bolt action rifles, breech loaders. Like the Mauser K-98, the Enfield, Lee 1, the Americans, I think they're using the Browning 1898. And what do the Chinese Imperial soldiers have? The Imperial Army that never modernized? Spears, swords, crossbows. For 55 days, the Europeans held out. But interestingly enough, within the Chinese government, unlike the Manchu nobles who were supporting Jershi, many of the Chinese nobles were like, yeah, this is probably not a good idea. One of the most significant one was Prince Qing, who actually was a distant relative of Jershi. Prince Qing would actually use his government offices to contact the Europeans, to inform them what's going on. And he also supported reconciliation. He was the one who said, hey, look, it's not all of China. Don't come in and blow us all up. Because, oh man, did the Western nations respond. Eight nations would mobilize their military forces. Not that you need to know, but there's representatives of them all up there. There are British, there's Russians, there's Japanese, there's Americans, there's Germans, there's Italian, French, Austrians. They would quickly put together an army of about 20,000. The Russians alone would move an army into Mongolia of about 200,000. And they, both forces started descending upon Peking. Well, to say that this was swift is an understatement. Ironclad dreadnought ships sailed up the Pu River, got within firing range of the Imperial capital, started opening fire, blew holes in the walls, and then the European soldiers stormed the city. They then did something shocking. Many of the soldiers began looting and plundering. Many of the Chinese who were against the Manchu would also join in. And they started identifying those people who were loyal to the Boxers. And these people were not given trials. They received summary executions. So, see this guy right there? Who's being held in place with a rope around his neck? That's like a machete. And if the photographer just waited a fraction of a second longer, he would have gotten him losing his head. Because, by the way, that's what happens to your body when you lose your head. See, his head's supposed to be up here. But all the blood pours out of the neck. The head should not be laying against the arm. No. no idea how many people were killed. Thousands. Anyone who supported the Boxers were identified and executed. And then, because once again the Europeans won, they imposed terms. But this time, something weird happened, sparked by the Americans, which I believe we talk about when we get to the end of the Japanese. Yes, we do. President Teddy Roosevelt was fearful that basically the Qing were done. And if the Allies did to China now what they had done in previous united efforts, like the Opium Wars, that essentially the imperial regime would completely collapse and China would descend into chaos. So, they would do something different. They would push for no more unequal treaties, no more spheres of influence, no more territorial recessions. Instead, they imposed the Boxer Protocol. Three elements. One, all government officials that supported the Boxers had to be killed. Except for Zhirshi. She would be removed as regent. Two, each allied nation could now garrison soldiers in the foreign legation. Previously, only the Germans had done that, but now each of the eight nations would all have entire units stationed guarding the embassies. The American embassy was guarded by Marines. And lastly, compensation. Money. China would have to pay 720 million ounces of silver. 720 million ounces of silver. You can do your own math. Current market rate per ounce is like $31 an ounce. So what are we talking? 2.4 billion dollars. Now, China would have 39 years to pay. Why did they give them 39 years? Well, that amount of money was more money than the Chinese government made in 5 years. Questions. Another war with the foreigners, another loss at the hand of the foreigners. The Boxer Rebellion would be the death knell of the Qing Dynasty. Because at this point, the nation started realizing that the days of the Manchu were coming to an end. It's been quiet. It was quiet all during my break. Goes nuts in class, and they can wait. In the wake of the Boxer Rebellion, all throughout China, little secret societies began organizing. And the aim of many of these secret societies was essentially time to get rid of the Qing. The dynastic circle had swung full circle. It was time to get them out. many of the names you may have heard of. There were the Triads. There was the Society of the White Lotus. There was the Society of the Elders and the Brothers. These were all underground organizations that kind of had like mafia structures. Now, some of them had been around for decades, but none of them were getting too far because of lack of coordination, lack of resources. But these would soon serve as cells that would become training ground for a resistance movement. Some of the first members, which is true in every revolutionary movement, revolutionaries are never poor people. Revolutionaries can't afford to revolt. They have to go and show up and do their job. But instead, most revolutionaries come from, you know, middle-class families. So many of the people that flocked to these secret societies were sons of merchants, sons of scholar gentry. People who actually did not have to work for a living because they could live off mommy and daddy. But because of their position, they could get educated. Some traveled to Europe. Some came to an America. Attended European and American universities, studied politics, economics, history. And it would be these intellectuals that they would get these ideas because they would see stories like what George Washington did in our country, or what happened during the French Revolution, or what happened in Haiti, or what happened in Central and South America, all of the countries that revolted against the Europeans. But they also got exposed to Marxist ideas. So these intellectuals came back and began calling for a revolution to save China from itself. Amongst the thousands of these figures, one would rise to national prominence. Dr. Sun Yat-sen. He emerged because he had the ability to present a simple, articulate message. He had been a member of the Heaven and Earth Society. The Heaven and Earth Society had cells in most of the country or the cities that Europeans had spheres of influence over. So they had foreign contacts. They had access to foreign money. They had access to foreign support. So Sun would emerge because he was articulate. He was capable of talking to people. And he would actually travel extensively in and around China, talking to common people, trying to understand their problems. And soon he became very, very popular. People looked to him for leadership. It would be Dr. Sun Yat-sen who would also give to those who are suffering a simple vision. He would establish his three principles. Nationalism. China should be for the Chinese, not the Manchu, not the English,
not the Russians. That all people should have a say in their government.
Whether they are rich or middle class or poor. And the government should exist to protect the people. To make sure that people can have jobs. To make sure that people can have homes. That people can earn enough money to take care of themselves and their family. So what was the goal? Simple. Expel the barbarians, revive Zhongguo, and establish him a republic. Well, this, of course, was revolutionary, because the biggest thing they were calling for was to end the dynasties, to end imperial rule, to essentially remove the past and implement the modern. Well, it was only a matter of time before people started rallying to Dr. Sun Yat-sen. All of the little splinter groups looked to him. They condemned the Manchu for failing to protect the Chinese. And they engaged in all types of acts of civic defiance. One of the interesting things, if you've ever seen any cartoons from China during this period, they depicted the stereotypical Chinaman as having like a long braid called a queue. Well, they had to do that because under Manchu law, only Manchu could cut their hair. So many of the Han people, out of defiance, began cutting off their queue. They also started local uprisings. They engaged in assassinations, act of sabotage. And by 1911, chaos is erupting everywhere. Then in a desperate move, the imperial throne called in the warlords. And the warlords basically said, "We're not doing anything for you." The most powerful of these provincial warlords, Yuan Shikai, would actually join with Sun Yat-sen. They would form a political party called the Kuomintang. And eventually they would march on the capital. By February 1912, the Manchus realized they had no choice but to give up their control of China. In February 15th, I believe, the last emperor of China, Puyi, would abdicate the throne. The Kuomintang would establish what became known as the Republic of China, which still exists today, by the way. The Kuomintang government is the government that controls Taiwan. Sun would be elected the first president. Yuan Shikai would be the first commander of the Chinese military. And in the end, these revolutionaries would destroy a system of government that had been in place for 2,500 years. 10 times longer than the entire history of this country. Gone in a blink of an eye. But here are my last thoughts, because I know I'm done. Out of time, rather. The Republic would be weak. It would be crippled by the Japanese in the 1930s, which would give rise to a communist revolution in the 1940s. And in the end, the Republic of China would only last 30 years before the Chai Coms, led by Mao Zedong, would come to power. who still control China today. But I did recently read an article that came out of China written by an anonymous scholar. There's actually a demand in the rural areas of China to bring the dynasties back because they're fed up with the communists. So, history in China never stops. All right, before you go, as I told the people who were here on time, which is only about half the class, good thing you're not my employees because I would fire you all. Many of you are going to run into problems on attendance. You are only allowed 4 absences. If you have more than 4, 3 points are going to get taken off your final average, up to 12. If you have more than 12, you're going to fail this class, regardless of what grade you have. We are also getting close to exam number 3, which will be your last exam on Engage, because the final is a paper exam in class. So if you've cheated your way through the semester, you're actually going to have to study for the final. Paper is due on April 22nd. That's all I got.
That Tuesday?
So the 6th? All right, so that's afterwards.